Well, Attorney Kathleen Nastri is with us from Koskoff and Beter, and they were involved in a very interesting lawsuit, and this was a case that originally had both a named defendant and a Stanford hospital. The hospital was ultimately dropped. The case originally was tried, and it resulted in a hung jury, but of course, this time around, a very different result. Kathleen Nastri, thank you for joining us today here on WATR.
Hey, Larry, it's good to be here.
Well, tell us, you know, at first a hung jury the first time this went around, second time a $58 million award. What was the difference?
Well, you know, the first time we tried the case, the jury was hung, but they were hung 5-1 in our favor. In other words, there were five people who had voted for the plaintiff and one person who was in favor of a decision on behalf of the defendant. So it wasn't a huge difference. It was, you know, 5-1 the first time and 6 in favor of us the second time. We did change some of the way we presented the case. We tried to make it simpler, certainly the second time, because it was very complicated, and we just happened to put it all in correctly.
Okay. I read, you know, the notice of filing the revised complaint, and why don't you summarize it for us, malpractice, and tell us a little bit about those who were affected, you know, the those who got the claim, and of course, what you alleged and what the jury agreed had occurred.
Sure. The case was originally filed in 2005. And it was against a Stanford obstetrician who was the individual defendant and his group. He has a group practice, as well as, again, Stanford Hospital initially. And the claim was on behalf of Kathy Dottillo, who is the mom in the case, and her son Danny, mm-hmm. who is now 8 years old. Danny was born on February 2nd, 2003 at Stanford Hospital. It was a cesarean section which had been planned. Kathy was a high-risk pregnancy throughout. And a cesarean section was necessary for a lot of reasons, including the fact that Danny was a breech baby. And when he was born, there was very clearly something awful that happened during the delivery. He was stuck. They were unable to get him out, even despite the fact that it was a cesarean section. And he was eventually diagnosed with cerebral palsy because of a deprivation of oxygen at the time of his delivery.
Okay. And, you know, when you read through this, those of us who are not attorneys, and you read about under circumstances then and there present, failed to adequately and properly care, treat, diagnose, monitor, failed to adequately, accurately, properly, and timely evaluate, ascertain the position of the infant plaintiff, delayed in performing a cesarean section, delayed in performing timely relieving incisions in the upper uterine sac. I mean, lots of stuff there. Now, how do you bring that to a jury to make it all understandable so that they know what is beyond the ability of a physician to control and what they are responsible for? Because, you know, look, we know that that doctor did not go in that day, you know, wanting something untoward to happen. So how do you know that it's his action versus just the normal course of events that get a little out of hand?
Yeah, well, let me say, first of all, that lawyers, while we may be very good at some things, are not necessarily good at writing things that are understandable by anyone other than ourselves.
Sure.
The case boiled down to two main claims against Dr. Viscarello. The first claim was that on January 31st, so 2 days before Danny was born, when Kathy Dottillo was in his office having some prenatal testing done, that there were signs that something was going wrong. Kathy's had these testings called biophysical profiles throughout her pregnancy. And there is a part of that test that is called a biophysical profile. It's an amniotic fluid index. The amniotic fluid index in Kathy's case had been dropping throughout the month of January. And why is that important? It's important because amniotic fluid is a measure of the baby's well-being, and it is a way that the baby stays protected and cushioned in the uterus. He won't compress his umbilical cord, and it's just a sign that everything is going well for the baby, one of the signs. When the amniotic fluid index dropped, it dropped by about half. And that was a dramatic, significant sign that our experts said should have been recognized by the physician who was taking care of this high-risk pregnancy, and she should have been delivered by cesarean section that day. On that day, Danny was 38-plus weeks along in his pregnancy, so he was a perfectly healthy term baby.
Okay.
2 days later, the doctor didn't do anything that day. He sent her home. 2 days later, Kathy's water broke, and she went into labor. So two things happened. Number one, this little amount of amniotic fluid that she had is now further depleted, which means there's very little protecting Danny while he's in the uterus. And the contractions begin, and they begin to push Danny down into Kathy's pelvis as if he's going to be delivered the old-fashioned way.
Mm-hmm.
And so when she gets to the hospital, by the time they get her down to the OR, what they discover is that he has been pushed so far down into the pelvis that they couldn't get him out.
Hmm.
And there was that delay in delivering him at that point that caused the oxygen deprivation. So we knew from the beginning of the case when the Dottilos came to see us that there was something wrong, something clearly wrong had happened. And what we do, which is what my office does in every case, is we hired a lot of experts to look at the case and to evaluate all these different issues for us.
Mm-hmm.
And we get advice from these experts and input from these experts on what went wrong. For example, initially in the case, the reason that Stanford Hospital was a defendant is because there was some delay in resuscitating Danny. So he is born and he's not breathing, and he needed to be intubated. They had to put a tube down his throat to help him to breathe. And the pediatrician who was taking care of him at the delivery had some trouble doing that. So Stanford Hospital was originally a defendant in the case. As the case progressed and as our experts continued to look at the issues, they told us that there was no consequence to Danny as a result of that delay. In other words, although there had been some delay, it did not do him any harm, and that's why we withdrew the case as to Stanford Hospital.
Okay, and they were involved in the first case with a hung jury?
No, they were not.
They never were. Okay.
They never were. Yep.
Okay.
They were let out of the case well before the trial began, the first time through.
Okay.
And it's important for people to understand that. My office, you know, Koskoff and Beter does a lot of medical malpractice cases.
Mm-hmm.
And we are very, very careful in the types of cases that we will take. And as soon as the experts who are helping us say, you know, this is an issue and this person should not be a defendant or this claim is not valid, we take care of that. And it's important for people to understand, because you hear a lot about...
Well, yeah, you know people's perception.
Right.
As everybody's, you know, chasing every ambulance. And so how do you avoid... Because let's be honest about it. I mean, you know, it is a practice, both law and medicine.
Yep.
It is not perfect. We are all human beings. And, of course, we don't want to scare good physicians away from accepting high-risk cases because, you know, that we may all be involved in a high-risk case. We want somebody there who's going to take the risk and... serve us, even if it is a, chancy thing. In this case, you were convinced and your experts were convinced that there had been negligence or there had been malpractice, correct, obviously, before you took it on. And you were able to convince six, regular folks that was the case.
Right, and actually, I think we were able to convince 11, because we convinced five out of the first six and then six out of the second six.
Oh, okay, fair enough. Now, what about the assessment of the $58 million? Now, that always gets everybody's attention as well. And what did you base that on? I know he needs care throughout his life, I guess, at this point. So how do you put a number on that?
Yeah, so the verdict is broken down into two categories. There are economic damages and non-economic damages. And the economic damages are simply the cost to take care of Danny for the rest of his life. So that's money that Danny doesn't get. His parents don't get it. It goes to doctors and therapists and rehabilitation specialists, special schooling, people who are going to do modifications to his home so that he can, you know, stay at home with his parents. That was $8.6 million. We had a lot of experts who had input into that, what we call a life care plan, who came up with those numbers, and an economist who testified about that as well. So that was the first part.
Yeah, I would think that's, frankly, even a little low, I mean, given his age.
Well, it was conservative.
Okay.
It was very clearly conservative. The second part, and by the way, everything that was in our life care plan, the jury gave us,
mm-hmm.
every penny.
Mm-hmm.
So they also, I think, thought it was, you know, probably conservative. The second part of the verdict is non-economic damages, and that is Danny's pain and suffering and disability and loss of ability. His life has been completely taken away from him. He is in a wheelchair. He doesn't walk, talk, eat, sit up, communicate. You know, he is a very, very significantly disabled child. And so the jury looked at that, and it's a hard thing to put a number on. And we told them, we did not ask for a specific number. We told them that it was up to them and that they were the experts on what those things were worth and that it was completely within their discretion to decide what the value was. And so that was a number they came up with completely on their own.
Okay, so these are average citizens of making up this jury, and that was the number they assessed. That is the highest award in the state's history for a jury trial?
It is.
And what was the next highest?
The next highest was a case called Oram, I think, O-R-A-M, which was a case that was tried down in Stanford, and it was a similar situation with a baby who was born with cerebral palsy. He was one of twins that was born. That was not my office's case. That was a law firm in Stanford that handled that case. And it was, I think it was $38
million. Mm-hmm, 38.
But I think what it's important for people to know is that we talked about earlier about, you know, scaring doctors out of the practice. These kinds of verdicts shouldn't have that effect and logically wouldn't have that effect. There are, I think, 20,000 physicians practicing in the state of Connecticut, 31 hospitals, and countless nursing homes and sort of skilled care facilities. There are less than 300 malpractice cases filed in Connecticut every year.
Mm.
So it's not like the people who are citizens of the state of Connecticut who are patients of physicians or hospitals are out there looking to file lawsuits. It doesn't happen. And lawyers who are looking at these cases and are in the business, if you want to call it a business, of filing malpractice cases are not filing cases that don't have merit. But sometimes when doctors do something that is wrong, that is negligent, the consequences are tragic. And that's how you end up very rarely with these kinds of very large verdicts.
Yeah, absolutely. But does that count the number of cases that somebody threatens a case and everybody settles the insurance company and it never goes to trial? The 300 is exclusive of those cases.
Well, you know, it would be very rare in a malpractice case for that to happen. I know that in, you know, automobile cases or premises cases where something bad happens to someone, that there are settlements before the case is actually filed.
Mm-hmm.
But in malpractice, because of the amount of time it takes pre-suit to review a case, and you know you have to have an expert opinion before you can even file your lawsuit. So, because of the time that goes into that pre-suit discovery investigation process,
mm-hmm.
and because the hospitals and the doctors have a lot to learn about what the case is all about as well, it is very, very rare that a case settles before it goes into litigation. And I've been practicing for 25 years, and it's happened to me just once.
Okay, let me ask you. The doctor in the case, Richard Viscarella.
Yes.
Now, you know, in Fairfield County. I mean, what happens to him? What happens to his life? I mean, I want to ask about Daniel, too, of course.
Yeah.
But what happens to a doctor like this?
Well, I don't know. And it's not that I'm not concerned about that. I don't wish, you know, ill on any physician, and certainly not Dr. Viscarello, and I agree with you, he didn't mean for this to happen on that particular day. But the fact is that he probably was underinsured. He made some business decisions about how much insurance to buy for his practice. He's a high-risk physician who handles high-risk pregnancies, and there are bad things that can happen when you're handling those kinds of cases. And he had an opportunity, and his insurance company had an opportunity before we went to trial the first time to settle the case for $2 million, and they declined.
Hmm, okay.
So they made some business decisions or ego decisions years ago that forced us to the situation where we were in front of a jury trying the case in Waterbury a couple weeks ago. It wasn't our decision to push the case through that way.
Okay. How is Daniel doing these days? What's his long-term prognosis? I assume that recovery from this is not going to occur. That's why the $8 million for his care. So
yeah.
Are there any expectations that he might retain or regain some capabilities or no?
No. Daniel has a kind of cerebral palsy, which is a permanent brain injury known as spastic quadriplegic cerebral palsy, and it is permanent. He is in a very, very good special school called St. Vincent's Special Needs, where they give him speech therapy and occupational therapy and physical therapy every day. He's home with his parents, and they take magnificent care of him. He has developed some very limited ability to communicate. He can say yes, and he can't say it. He can indicate with his hands yes or no for a lot of simple questions. But he is likely to be in a wheelchair for the rest of his life. He probably will never eat food. Other than what he gets directly
yeah.
fed into his stomach, he'll never talk. You know, it's a very, very dire situation, and it's very permanent. Unless there's some miracle of technology or medicine. It's permanent.
Okay. Now, you did this, you tried this in Waterbury. Why was it tried here? And what kind of jury did you have? I mean, we know we have an area with a lot of unemployment. I mean, and do you look for certain types of people? I'm just trying to be very blunt about it, who are really susceptible to the messaging, to the concerns about the family. In other words, this was a very generous group here that gave $50 million for those non-involved damages in terms of, direct care. So they were obviously very moved by your case.
Right. The case was originally filed by us in Stamford. In Connecticut, there are rules about where you can file your cases. We have separate judicial districts. And so this one went to Stamford because that's where the parties lived. Connecticut has a system called the complex litigation docket, and cases like this, which are likely to be lengthy and have a lot of issues that need to be resolved, sometimes get transferred to the complex docket. When that happens, you go to one of the regional complex dockets, and this one just happened to end up in Waterbury, which is how it ended up in Waterbury. We didn't choose Waterbury. That's where we went at the direction of the court system.
Okay.
Having said that, we did have a chance in Connecticut. Again, we have the right to pick jurors through an individual voir dire process. Each person gets questioned, but we do not look for a particular type of juror. What you are lucky at the end of the day is if you end up with six people who can just be fair and open-minded, and that's what we got in this case. We purely, again, by chance, ended up with six men as our jurors, which is very unusual.
Yeah.
But it was sort of just the luck of the way they came into the process over the course of the days that we were up there picking a jury. And they were ranged in age from 20 to 69, mostly on the younger end of that spectrum, but they were a very thoughtful, diligent group. Most of them were fully employed. The older gentleman was retired from a long career with the college administration system, but they were just a real thoughtful, hardworking group of people, and I don't believe for a second that the amount of the verdict was based on sympathy. I think that they really thought about the enormity of what had happened here and just thought that that was the right number.
Okay. Now, in closing, I only have about a minute for you, but a lot of people, look at a lot of the billboards and ads, personal injury, and, it seems like people are concerned that there may be a lot of lawyers chasing opportunities. In the minute we have, why don't you defend the practice and tell us what people are not understanding about, these kinds of cases, not this particular one, but in general,
injury. I guess what I'd have to say is that the personal injury lawyers who are out there in Connecticut and around the country take a risk when they take on a case. We take cases on a contingency fee basis, which means if our clients are successful, then we get paid, and if our clients are not successful, we don't get paid. And along the way, we invest not only our time, which is significant, but our resources, our money in pursuing the case and making sure the clients get the best representation possible. And if it were not for lawyers like Koskoff, Koskoff and Beter and the other personal injury firms around the state of Connecticut, people like the Dottillos, who have absolutely no financial resources available to them, would not be able to have access to our system. Corporations can hire lawyers, and maybe doctors can hire lawyers, and insurance companies can hire lawyers, but the average citizen cannot pay those kinds of legal fees short of a contingency fee system. So it is what gives, it levels the playing field, and it gives people access to a system that they would not otherwise have access to.
Okay, fair enough. I just wanted to give you that opportunity. And what of a fee like this does the firm retain?
Well, the fee always depends on what we are able to collect, of course. And at this point in the case, we have no idea what of this will be collectible. There are post-verdict motions pending. I'm sure there will be some appellate issues the defense will raise. So we just don't have any idea right now.
Okay. Attorney Kathleen Nastri, fascinating, kind of an anatomy and dissection of a case. No, really, I think it's really helpful to people because we hear so many things and we have so many preconceived notions. Koskoff, Koskoff and Beter, Attorney Kathleen Nastri. And I, congratulate you. Obviously, you did well for your client, and they certainly have many, many other issues to deal with for a lifetime. So I thank you very much for being here on WHER.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Larry.
Okay, back in a moment. Gabe.